It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, fossil hunting is hot, from deserts that were once ocean floors to the urban jungle. What's driving what some are calling America's new bone rush? Find out more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, hey, do you have a minute? I want to have a one-on-one conversation with you about race and gender and sexual orientation and mistakes we might make when we talk about those things. Okay, your heart rate might have gone up a bit there. You might think, am I going to say something that offends lots of people? Is this going to be a painful, difficult conversation? Is Rob going to say something cringeworthy? If just thinking about these kind of talks makes you uncomfortable, you're not alone. It can be easier to not have these conversations at all. But hang on. Our next guests say it's important to talk about these topics, and they have a lot of advice to help have good conversations. And they have a lot of experience and research to back it up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a difficult conversation with friends, coworkers, classmates, family, or others about issues related to race or gender, sexual orientation, other issues of identity? What went poorly? What went well? What do you wish you'd done differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow are professors at the New York University School of Law, where they run the Meltzer Center for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing: How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kenji, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kenji, I think, as I just said, sometimes the easiest path is to not talk about these issues of identity so much. A huge part of your book is making the case that, yeah, it is important. It's worth the effort. Convince people who might be skeptical.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the first case to be made is that silence is no longer viewed to be neutrality. I think silence in many quarters is viewed to be complicity and an unjust status quo. And so simply remaining on the sidelines is not an option, just for the kind of blowback that you might receive from individuals who need you in these conversations. And then in a more uplifting way, I think that we all have values as individuals who want to create a more inclusive society for all, to stand up for those values. And we're not going to be able to do that if we are so frozen in fear that we opt out of these conversations or run away from them.
And David, I think one response people might have, I'll throw me out there as an example. I'm white, male, and straight. And somebody in my position might say, if I have this conversation with somebody who doesn't meet one of those categories, I'm going to be blamed for something. I'm going to be the bad guy. I'm going to be made to feel shame. How do you try to assure people that it doesn't have to be that way?
Well, we specifically wrote this book to be shame-free. We don't like shaming approaches to these conversations. In fact, one of the core principles that we're trying to get across in our book is to shift people in emphasis away from cancel culture toward what we call coaching culture. That is, rather than just shaming and blaming people who make mistakes in these conversations, we really want to wrap our arms around people and give them practical tools for how to have these conversations more effectively, like a coach would, so that you don't get ostracized, but rather you're given the skills like how to apologize, how to disagree, how to build curiosity, resilience, all of the practical tools you need to have these conversations effectively.
Okay, Kenji, shame-free, but not necessarily easy. There can be some discomfort in these conversations, and you use the phrase in the book, the democratization of discomfort. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of discomfort that is kind of par for the course for these conversations. And I think one of the things that we have to realize is that if these conversations have seemed more comfortable, right, prior to the last, say, 5 or 10 years, it's not that the discomfort hasn't been there, it's that the discomfort has been entirely borne by the other party to the conversation. So that if I'm having a conversation about gender with a woman sort of 20 years ago, it might mean that the conversation is acutely uncomfortable for her, but totally comfortable for me. And one of the things that's changed in the last 20 years is that when we have those conversations, that woman might have higher expectations of what kinds of behavior and understanding she expects from me. And I might experience that in turn as a form of discomfort, because now the discomfort is being shared between us. She's not assuming the full burden of that, and it's more fairly distributed across the two of us. So oftentimes people come to us and they say, like, oh my gosh, like, why was that conversation so uncomfortable? It was like, you know, fingers on a chalkboard. I was like dying to get out of that room. And a response is to say, maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe the question isn't, why is this conversation so uncomfortable? But rather, why has it been so comfortable until now? And oftentimes the answer is because the other side, the non-dominant side of the conversation, has been bearing the brunt of that discomfort until this point.
If I'm criticized for anything, I'm human, a particular kind of human, I can get defensive. And my initial response isn't necessarily going to be great. And you two write that in these conversations about race and identity, when somebody's, you know, called on something they may have done wrong or that made somebody uncomfortable, their defensive reactions can be in a handful of categories: avoid, deflect, deny, attack. We may not have time to go into all of them in detail, but how do we check that initial response to, I don't know, to fight back or just run away from this conversation?
Yeah, as you say, you know, avoid, deflect, deny, and attack are the most common responses that we see. And you can think of avoid and deflect a little bit like flight in a fight or flight response. So you're running away from the conversation, whereas deny and attack are the fight mode. That's where you're standing in the conversation, but you're pushing back hard on the other person, and in some cases making it quite personal and attacking them. And so we think that the key skill, or one of the key skills to develop to overcome these ADDA behaviors, is resilience. So building the kind of emotional stamina and strength to be able to persist in these conversations despite the overwhelming discomfort that you may feel. And so one of the tools that we offer in the book is to give people the ability to adopt a growth mindset. It's very common in these conversations that when you make a mistake, you think about it as a reflection of your innate moral character. So that must mean I'm a terrible person, I'm a racist, I'm a sexist, what have you. What we want people to do instead is move to what the psychologist Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset, meaning that you respond to a mistake as an opportunity to learn. So if I make a mistake when I'm playing the piano, I don't think that makes me a terrible person. I just think I need to practice more to improve the next time. And we want to give people the tools to be able to take that same attitude of growth mindset into this arena of conversations about identity.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you feel uncomfortable doing that, I totally understand. But if you have an anecdote to share, a question for a guest, we would love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kenji, something David just said reminded me of an anecdote later in your book when you're talking about, you know, when you see somebody else, maybe a family member or someone saying something. The example is, I think it was a woman. Her uncle said something about, I think, Mexican immigrants, a disparaging remark. Her approach was really interesting. It wasn't, why would you say that? It was, I know you're a good person. I know you would like run into a burning building and save someone. You wouldn't ask about their immigration status. Can you talk about that kind of approach to checking someone on that?
Yes, it's actually a beautiful connection that you're drawing there, because one might say, okay, I can have all the growth mindset in the world, but I'm still going to be afraid, because even if I'm compassionate towards myself when I make a mistake, other people might not be compassionate right. towards me, and they might cancel me. And oftentimes that's what we're really afraid of. So we make a huge point in the book about saying that part of being a good ally in these conversations is being an ally not just to the person who's been harmed, but also to the source of non-inclusive behavior. And what we mean by that is that when somebody messes up, you know, our first instinct might be to pile onto that person, but we have to understand that that's all of us. It's not a question of whether we're going to make a mistake. It's a question of when we will make that mistake. And so it behooves us to be compassionate and kind and to help people of goodwill grow past the mistakes that we're making. So it's really the flip side of the growth mindset that David was talking about. The glorious story that you mentioned comes from the wonderful Loretta Ross, a scholar up at Smith, who talks about how we need to stop calling people out and start calling people in. And so what she says to the uncle who makes this opprobrious comment about immigrants is to actually affirm him as a person, saying, I know you, Uncle Frank. I know you're an incredible human being. If there was a burning building, you would rush in to save it. And you wouldn't care if the person in that building was gay or an immigrant or what have you. So please help me reconcile the incredibly loving, wonderful Uncle Frank, whom I know you to be, with the words that just came out of your mouth. And that, we think, is a wonderful way to approach somebody, because it's not just like hate the sin, not the sinner. it's affirm the person, right? You know, bring the person back into it and say, you know, you're a wonderful human being. Help me understand how that conduct or that comment was consistent, right, with the ideals that I know that that human being has.
We're talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this kind of conversation maybe around a family dinner table in a workplace diversity training? What went well, do you think? What was painful? Painful in a good way or just bad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. A lot of practical advice for having difficult, potentially difficult conversations. If you're willing to share an experience or a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you need some advice on how to have this kind of conversation and how to approach it. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, we've heard a few of your principles on, you know, how to have good, productive conversations. I want to check out another one now, cultivate curiosity. How do we do that and how do we use it to benefit ourselves when we're talking about these issues of identity?
So we point out in our chapter on curiosity that oftentimes when we show up to these conversations from the more dominant group side, so as a white person, if I'm entering a conversation about race, or as someone who doesn't have a disability, if I'm entering a conversation about disability, we often enter those conversations where with a lot of knowledge that we lack. So if I'm speaking with someone who uses a wheelchair, I won't know necessarily about where the curb cuts and ramps are in my neighborhood or what kinds of biases or barriers that people with disabilities encounter as they go about their lives. Whereas the person that I'm speaking with often will know that information or at least know it a lot better than I will. And so we think it's really important for people like me in that conversation to be humble as we enter those conversations about the areas where we lack knowledge and to listen generously to the perspective of the person that we're speaking to and respect the extra knowledge that that person likely brings into the conversation. And so a couple of techniques for doing that. One is just do some research. I mean, you're never going to be able to fully understand what it's like to belong to a different social group than your own, but you can do a lot of ordinary research, like listening to podcasts or reading books or reading articles about the experience of people from other groups. And then when you're actually in a conversation with someone, we think it's really important to share your own perspective in the conversation tentatively and listen generously to the other person. So when you're sharing your own perspective, rather than making statements of definitive fact as though you know everything there is to know, you might instead use I statements. So say things like, I wonder, I feel, I think, and even explicitly say to the person that you're offering your perspective with that humility. So you might say, this is a draft, so please edit it, things like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Celia is with us in Madison. Celia, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate you and your speakers very much. I used to teach communications as a consultant, and I agree 100% with what they're saying, that if somebody has said something or acted out in some way, discuss a behavior or the words as soon as possible so you don't drift into you're a bad person. And since we're only supposed to be facilitators, we couldn't tell people what to do. So what we finally fell back on was asking the person, well, what would you say are the consequences of what you just did or said? So they teach themselves.
Celia, interesting. Thanks for sharing that experience. Kenji, the two of you work a lot in the business world. What do you think of Celia's approach?
I really love it. And I really appreciate the call as well. You know, one of the things that this highlights is the distinction between intent and impact that we often focus on. So, you know, oftentimes when we're having these conversations and someone calls us out or tries to call us in on something, we immediately deflect to go back to our earlier conversation. To our good intentions, right? And so we channel switch and we say, well, my intent was really good, and so therefore you should give me a pass. And one of the things that, like Celia, we urge people to do is to focus not on their own intent, but focus on the impact that the action or the comment might have had on the other person. Because if you focus on impact, you know, that's much more likely to get at the nub of what is bothering the other person. I can have all the good intent in the world and have stepped on your foot by accident, you know, but it doesn't take away any of the pain that I've caused. And so keeping the frame steadily on the consequences of the actions, on the impact of the action rather than your own intent, is a really good practice.
Celia, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. David, Celia brings up a situation that is, I guess, reactive. Something has happened. We're dealing with it now. Is there a way for a business or school or whatever institution is to create, I don't know, I guess an environment where you can avoid some of those incidents or have that framework for dealing with them from the get-go?
Absolutely. And we think that a really critical concept in this area is called allyship, which may be familiar to some of your listeners, which is the idea that all of us, no matter what demographic group we belong to, have a role to play to build that kind of inclusive culture. And we have worked with a lot of organizations that have really tried to embed that concept of allyship into their organization through education, research, training, and the way that they talk about diversity and inclusion issues inside their organizations. Because the idea behind allyship is a really simple one, which is that when you witness, you know, non-inclusive behavior, or even before witnessing non-inclusive behavior, you can show up to these conversations enacting a lot of the principles that we describe in the book by displaying resilience and curiosity, by disagreeing respectfully, by apologizing authentically. And by doing that at the outset, we hope that a lot of the kinds of incidents that we've been describing can be avoided if people have adopted those principles at the outset.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Kenji, there'll be a portion of the audience listening who hears the words identity and diversity has a framework on that where that says, yeah, I'm going to tune out now. This is an attack on people who are white or male, or the list goes on and on. And we're seeing that in the political world, certainly. What would you say to reach out to them and try to bring them into the conversation?
I would say that, you know, there are people who, you know, are just ideologically opposed to the project of a more inclusive society, and that those individuals should have their opinions respected, but also should kind of be left alone. So one of our great colleagues, Dolly Chug here at NYU, a psychologist, says D&I, like many other things, diversity inclusion, that is, obeys a 20-60-20 rule, where 20% are just unbelievably, you know, for it, they're champions, 20% are ideologically opposed to it. And then most people are in that 60% in the movable middle. So I think when people sort of have this allergy to diversity and inclusion, you first need to figure out where they sit, whether they're in the kind of opposed 20%, in which case just leave them alone. They're entitled to their opinion. They're not going to move any more than I'm going to move from my commitments to diversity and inclusion. But if you're talking to that middle 60%, it's really important to meet the concerns of that middle 60%, because oftentimes what I feel like is that I'm standing at one end of a room and say, like, Ron DeSantis or Sarah Huckabee Sanders come to mind as people who have recently come out against diversity and inclusion initiatives. We're standing at the other end of the room. And so we're, you know, totally at loggerheads. We're not going to persuade each other, but we're talking to the people in the middle of the room and trying to get them to come to our side. And what I would say to the person who's in the middle, who's undecided about how they feel about diversity and inclusion issues, is, can you actually allow us to challenge ourselves as the people who want to convince you that D&I has a great value proposition in terms of creating a more equitable, a more just, a more inclusive society, to sort of change tacks? Because I think too often, again, we've been talking to you in terms of this fear-based rhetoric of, if you make one mistake, you'll get canceled. And of course, the more we talk about canceling people or hurting people when they make, you know, genuine good faith mistakes, the more the other side looks more attractive, because the other side is saying, say whatever you want. And then if you disagree, if other people disagree with you, then you can just call them crazy and denigrate them. So what we want to say instead, again, going back to the point about moving from cancel culture to coaching culture, is we want to put an arm around the people in the middle and to say, you have these ideals that are really worth fighting for, of a more inclusive, egalitarian society. We are a more diverse society, so these conversations are, you know, inescapable. But what we want to do for you is not to shame you. We want to hold you to very, very high standards, right? But we're not going to shame you in reaching them. We're going to actually give you all the support that you need, and we're going to give you actual skills, which cancel culture emphatically does not, in order to have these conversations so that you can have guardrails, right, around you, so that the degree to which you'll fail or your likelihood of success, right, change, right? Your degree of failure is going to be much smaller. Your likelihood of success is going to be much greater. And I think that one of the mistakes that people in the D&I community have made with the best of intentions is to lean into the kind of punitive aspects of diversity and inclusion and not lean into the kind of more joyful, skill-based, you know, this is about human flourishing aspects of diversity and inclusion.
And David, with just a half a minute, one piece of advice you give in the book, useful to all of us, a tip for making a good apology.
Yeah, so we think apologies are actually fairly simple because they follow the four R's of recognition, responsibility, remorse, and redress. So first, recognize the harm. Second, take responsibility for causing the harm. Third, show remorse. So be sincere in your expression of contrition. And then fourth, give some redress. So actually take action to back up your words so that it's not just all talk.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Kenji, thanks for being with us today.
What a great conversation. Thank you.
I've been talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing: How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an author shares stories of people dealing with a diagnosis of mental illness and how they shape their identities in moments of crisis in the new book, Strangers to Ourselves. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Well, it's winter. I don't know if you noticed. And sometimes you want your food to give you that splash of sunshine. We're going to brighten up our winter meals with some citrus flavor. I've been doing this more and more lately. Really looking forward to this conversation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, with President Biden highlighting his economic agenda in Wisconsin yesterday, we'll check out partisan claims made about the economy and find out what matters most when it comes to your financial future. First, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with the Dobbs decision over the summer, groups opposed to abortion have shifted their focus to medication abortions and abortion pills. The court ruling left it up to states to decide their own laws on abortion access, but these pills can cross state lines and create complicated questions about jurisdiction. A federal judge in Texas is currently reviewing a lawsuit seeking to revoke the FDA's approval of one of the most common drugs used for abortion, mifepristone, that would remove it from the market even in states where abortion is legal. According to data from the Guttmacher Institute, abortion providers reported over 50% of all abortions used those medications in 2020, even before Roe was overturned. A ruling on that federal lawsuit is expected in the next week. Maybe as soon as tomorrow, it could have a widespread impact on abortion access. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these abortion pills and the laws that surround them? Do you think that they should be unapproved by the FDA? Do you want to see the court ban them, or do you think it should be left to the states, or do you want to see them legal across the board? And how should they be administered? A lot of questions there, too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Rebouchet is the James E. Beasley Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She's a leading scholar in reproductive health law and family law. She recently published a paper called The New Abortion Battleground that was cited by the Supreme Court. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Pre-Dobbs, what was the state of legal regulation of these of mifepristone and other abortion other medications used in abortions?
So medication abortion, which is two drugs, before Dobbs was regulated like other abortion services, whether it be surgical or aspiration abortion. States generally didn't treat medication abortion differently, although a few states did target medication abortion by trying to require that a physician be in person to hand it out, to require ultrasound, to require other ways in which the abortion service was carried out. But medication abortion, like other types of abortion, is really different in two ways. It's only approved by the FDA, Federal Food and Drug Administration through 10 weeks of pregnancy. And it's pills. So it's mifepristone, the drug you mentioned that the FDA regulates closely, and misoprostol, a second drug that you take after mifepristone. And it's before Dobbs and before the more recent FDA changes to the law, it had not been taken up by as many people as one would have thought medication abortion would have been suited for. But that's really changing.
Can you talk about those new FDA changes you just mentioned?
Sure. So the FDA, before Dobbs was decided during the pandemic, lifted a restriction on mifepristone, that first drug in a medication abortion, which essentially required people to pick it up at a healthcare facility, a clinic, a hospital, right? During the pandemic, the FDA was sued to lift that restriction because it was thought that requiring people to go to pick up a drug that they can take at home without any provider supervision increased patient provider contact and increased the risk of contracting COVID-19. A court suspended it after, a series of steps. The FDA decided on the basis of evidence that actually people didn't need to go to a clinic to pick up the pills. Why that's important is because before that rule change, most people, everyone had that you couldn't go to a pharmacy to pick up abortion pills. You couldn't have them mailed to you. Lifting the in-person requirement has allowed online clinics to deliver medication abortion services and mail the pills to people at their homes or at any location of their choosing, so long as it's legal to do so. So what's really changing is the means by which people can receive medication abortion.
Now, here's Dobbs. And now states are in charge of this, and things get complicated. Can you talk about the range of laws as they apply to these pills now?
So what's now complicated is before Dobbs, states couldn't ban abortion, including medication abortion, if it was before the pregnancy was viable. Now states can, and about a third of the country bans abortion from the earliest stages of pregnancy, which includes abortion pills. So you have really a map that looks pretty stark for prohibition or permission. Other states, by and large, allow medication abortion subject to some restrictions. And so you have a really a map of the United States that where characterized mostly in the Midwest, in the South and Midwest, abortion's not permitted at all. And now on the coast and in various states, abortion through different stages of pregnancy, that is permitted. What we see happening is that people, even in states where abortion is banned now, are still ordering abortion pills online, not through those virtual clinics that I mentioned, but through other services that exist outside the United States. We also know that people are able to navigate the internet, mail forwarding in a way that also lets them have access to mifepristone and misoprostol, even if they are living in a state that bans it.
Talking to Rachel Rabouchet with the Temple University Law School, looking at abortion pills, laws, lawsuits challenging the availability of the medications, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, that brings us to this legal challenge in Texas right now, looking to effectively say FDA unapproved this medication. What's going on? What's at stake?
So this is a lawsuit taken by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. It's a group that does not support abortion, and they sued to argue that the FDA, when it approved mifepristone to end pregnancies in 2000, 22 years ago, acted outside of the agency's authority, that the FDA misapplied its statutory authority, and for that reason, with some other reasons, the court in Texas should take mifepristone off the national market. It should essentially say the FDA was wrong then, it should be removed now. The Biden administration through the DOJ has countered that the drug was approved over 22 years ago. That's a long time for a drug to be approved and then for it to claim that it was approved incorrectly. That in fact, the FDA didn't rush to approve mifepristone. It took years. They denied the application a couple of times before, and that this had all been investigated over the course of the last two decades. The reason people are watching this case is because it was filed and will be heard by a court that has a pretty strong track record of delivering opinions that are hostile to abortion rights. And so there's a lot of speculation that potentially even tomorrow when the decision may come out, that mifepristone could face a national injunction, which means it'd be off the market, even for states that still have abortion as legal.
We're talking to Temple University Law Professor Rachel Rebouchet about abortion pills and efforts to restrict them by state laws, by a federal lawsuit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the legal status, the use of these abortion pills? Do you think they should be removed from the market? Abortion under Wisconsin's 1849 law is effectively illegal, except in very rare instances. Do you think that there should be efforts to stop the use of these pills, the mailing of these pills or driving of these pills into Wisconsin? What could that look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Rachel Rebouchet, law professor and dean at Temple University, with us today to look at anti-abortion groups' new focus on abortion pills and some of the legal challenges ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, for a state where abortion is legal and where lawmakers want to make sure that abortion pills aren't coming into their state, what kind of enforcement and surveillance efforts are we starting to see to try to do that?
I think you see some states like South Carolina proposing bills that would ban information on how to receive pills online, how to order them, or how to use a mail forwarding for ordering pills, having them shipped and then forwarded to you in another state. I think we're seeing some criminal investigation, people who are self-managing their abortions, ordering pills online, and then having complications arriving at ERs and then having states not use abortion laws to charge them, but other laws like fetal assault or the like. I think that we'll see states start to search people's digital footprint to see if they are trying to procure abortion pills online. And I don't think that these are going to be easy policies to enforce. I think that they could very potentially incite a lot of backlash from the public, which it's clear assumes by and large that their health data and their private information should stay that private.
If it were to be ruled or unapproved by court order, as in this case in Texas, then what? These drugs are out there. They're on store shelves right now, or pharmacy shelves, I should say, not right out in the open. What then?
And I should have added that one of the things the FDA did is also permit pharmacies to seek certification to dispense mifepristone where it's legal. No, pharmacies haven't done that yet,
right,
except for an online pharmacy, which mails pills, Honeybee Health. But yeah, there is a nationwide injunction, a couple of things. The FDA could reinstate its safety restrictions, its rules could reinstate mifepristone on the market, but that's going to take time. So there will be a gap between this injunction taking force and the FDA acting. Providers might start using the second drug only in a medication abortion. It is possible to terminate a pregnancy with just the second drug, misoprostol. You might see a change in clinical practice. I think in you would absolutely see an uptick in the number of people ordering mifepristone and misoprostol online from other countries, going across the border to bring the drugs back into the country. You know, I think it might stop the sale of mifepristone through the manufacturers, but it's not going to stop people from seeking out abortion pills.
Joe from Eau Claire called, couldn't stay on the line. He said he thinks there needs to be better access to these abortion pills. The laws need to be relaxed, Joe says. And that reminds me, Rachel, you write in one of the pieces I mentioned that some states are trying to take action to provide access to these pills. What are we seeing in those states?
So there are seven states that have passed laws in anticipation that their providers who are providing abortions that are legal in state will be attacked from out of state. A state like, I guess, most recently Illinois, won't allow its providers to be sued in its state courts or subject to criminal discipline or professional discipline. A state like Massachusetts is trying to protect providers who are providing telehealth services for abortion by saying that their protection exists, applies regardless of where the patient is. These have been called shield laws, and they anticipate the coming reality where states try to apply their abortion laws outside of their borders. There's good reason to think that those policies or those attempts have constitutional problems. We have a right to travel in this country. We protect interstate commerce, but those haven't been tested out in courts, and courts could disagree about whether or not Texas, for instance, can create a private cause of action to sue anybody who helps a Texan leave Texas to seek an abortion in another state where abortion is legal.
A lot of moving parts here, Rachel. What do you have your eye on most closely when it determines the future of the law as it applies to these abortion-related medications?
It's a great question. I think I've been thinking a lot with a couple of great co-authors, David Cohen and Greer Donnelly, about the FDA's role here. There are two lawsuits that have been filed that do the opposite of the litigation we were just talking about in Texas that claim that the FDA, because it regulates medication abortion so closely, should trump state laws that contradict FDA policy. And if courts were to agree, that would create a medication abortion-sized hole in abortion bans for that state, potentially across the nation. And that, I think, is an interesting strategy that's also not been tested, but it also suggests another avenue by which medication abortion could become more accessible. The FDA could continue to remove the other restrictions that are on mifepristone, which would increase its availability in states where it's legal, but probably ultimately nationwide.
And briefly, as we wrap up, if this court, this federal court in Texas, does in fact unauthorize mifepristone, would you expect to see appeals to that ruling?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what we have ahead is just more litigation. You know, the majority opinion in Dobbs made the argument that Roe v. Wade needed to be overturned because it was unworkable. And that's a way of saying that created tests and opinions, decisions that had inconsistent results that were hard to apply. But we're seeing not a more workable set of laws now, and that the legal landscape is really defined by this interstate conflict and this litigation over what states can and cannot do, what the federal government can and cannot do.
Rachel, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Rabouchet, the James E. Beasley Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She's with us today to talk about the legal status of abortion pills and the pushback against them from abortion critics. Like the rest of the country, since about 2010, Wisconsin has seen a slew of major retail closures. But as Joe Schultz reports, local communities are getting creative in finding new uses for those former malls and big box stores.
Pickle Pro Courts on Madison's north side is packed as people participate in a pickleball tournament. The indoor facility features multiple courts, each contained with netting. It's open 24/7 to members. But the site wasn't always a bustling athletic space. In fact, it spent most of its life as a vacant former grocery store in Madison's Northside Town Center strip mall.
It was literally vacant space for 20 years.
That's Patrick Reha, the owner of Pickle Pro Courts, which opened last August. Reha worked to convert the deserted store into a state-of-the-art pickleball facility.
We had to put in all new electrical, all new plumbing, all new flooring, all new lighting, and so everything was required new, but we ended up with a great facility that people love.
The retail industry has seen thousands of closures since 2010. The Great Recession was especially hard on retail. And then, as the national economy began to recover, Amazon and other online retailers continued to cut into brick-and-mortar sales. In 2017 alone, the U.S. saw more than 7,000 retail stores close. And industry analysts predict another 30,000 to 80,000 could close in the next 2 years. That's created a lot of empty buildings in a lot of Wisconsin communities. Recently, though, many of Wisconsin's former retail spaces have found new life. A portion of Green Bay's East Town Mall is now a manufacturing facility for American Tent. And that's not the only community that's revitalized a former retail facility. At Mineshaft in Oshkosh, arcade games were to life as patrons blast alien invaders and race in Mario Kart. This site was once a Walmart, but when the retailer moved to a bigger location across the highway, its old property became a blight on the community. It was razed in 2007. In the late 2010s, Mineshaft owner Tom Masters and other developers worked with the city to revitalize the decaying retail plaza. They built a large, rustic, brick and wooden building in place of the old Walmart. After opening the Mineshaft in 2020, Masters plans to grow the restaurant's game room, add another dining room, and build an outdoor dining space.
I would say that hopefully in this next year or two that we would be expanded.
In the same former strip mall as Mineshaft, a former JCPenney has also been converted into Extreme Customs, a company that sells custom rims and tires. Rob Klayman is with the Oshkosh Chamber of Commerce. He says revitalizing those properties was important.
Having this great redevelopment there as people enter Oshkosh, it just kind of transforms the image that we have when you're coming into the community.
While there are still plenty of vacant big box stores across Wisconsin, these projects show that former retail locations can be transformed into economic assets to their local communities. In Janesville, leaders hope to turn a former Sears into an indoor sports complex that could have an annual economic impact of $23 million. The Woodman Sports and Convention Center would host conferences and youth sports tournaments, with a year-round ice rink and an area that could be used for indoor soccer or basketball. Jennifer Petrozillo with the City of Janesville says the project aims to boost local tourism.
It really allows us to diversify our economic drivers and expand into the sports tourism market.
Today, that property is still just an abandoned Sears, but Janesville officials hope the Sports and Convention Center can open in fall 2024. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, following President Biden's stop in DeForest yesterday, we talked to a Wisconsin economist about the economic agendas of both parties and how they affect our employment prospects, inflation, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.